live film of Fleetwood Mac on stage.
Anything that could happen to a rock and roll band has happened to Fleetwood Mac. 5 decades of hits and sellout world tours, over 60 million albums sold worldwide, but at a huge cost.
Breaks my heart what happened.
Multiple breakups.
I'm not looking for love, I'm looking out for love.
Fallouts, fistfights, legendary indulgence.
You know, like little kids in a toy shop.
Long-term dependence.
I thought it was going to kill me.
And yet... they're still selling out stadiums. They've been to hell and back. But 4 decades on, it's not over yet.
BBC, Fleetwood Mac, Don't Stop. A set list lying on top of an album cover.
Fleetwood Mac are one of the biggest bands in the world. But right from the start, that stardom came at a price.
Back at the beginning, it was a blues band.
John McVie, bassist. Black and white film of the bright lights of London's West End, then young people dancing.
Fleetwood Mac were conceived in the heady blues explosion of 1960s London, in a scene that would spawn some of our greatest rock legends. Fleetwood Mac had their own secret weapon, standing behind Mick Fleetwood and John McVie in this first lineup, guitarist Peter Green.
Peter picked up a guitar and just blossomed immediately into this monster, very individualistic guitar player.
We're now going to do our latest single called Oh Well.
He simply, for me, is the best thing that ever came out of England. The touch that he had, the songs that he wrote, Oh Well.
About the shape I'm in, I can't sing, I ain't pretty, and my legs are thin. But don't ask me what I think of you, I might not give the answer that you want me to.
When it came to the band looking for a name, I think it was Peter's very strong desire not to become Peter Green is God, and Eric Clapton is God, and Jeff Beck, you know, Jimmy Page, you know, he just didn't want that. He wanted to be in a band. Peter said, this band's called Fleetwood Mac.
Frontman Peter Green had named the band after his rhythm section. But despite his retiring nature, the band got bigger. And in 1969, with songs like Albatross going to number one, they outsold the Beatles. Peter's response was to try and give away the royalties to the hits he kept writing.
Now when the day goes to sleep, and a full moon looks.
Film of Peter Green walking. Mick Fleetwood.
If you listen to the words, it's a man crying out for help.
The lyrics printed on paper.
He obviously had the beginnings of demons creeping into his world.
John.
Breaks my heart what happened.
While on tour in Germany, Peter Green was met by local scenesters, Rainer Langens, and the alluring Uschi Obermeier, who were planning a Bavarian Woodstock, and invited him back to their commune.
I think we'd just done the gig, and then these two people dangled this lady in front of him. She's very pretty. And then went away to this Schloss, and that's where he did acid. And all it took was a couple of tabs. And he never came back.
A kaleidoscopic view of a black and white portrait photograph of Peter.
Mm-hmm.
Mick and John carried on without Peter. And in 1970, were joined by John's wife, blues singer Christine McVie. But they were less lucky with guitarists and frontmen. In 1971, on a US tour, Jeremy Spencer left his hotel to visit a bookstore on Hollywood Boulevard and was recruited by religious cult, the Children of God. In 1972, guitarist Danny Kirwin, who shared the fateful German acid trip with Peter Green, exited the band after smashing his guitar against a dressing room wall in LA. In 1973, they released a new album with guitarist Bob Weston, who promptly had an affair with Mick's wife, model Jenny Boyd, and was asked to leave. By 1974, Fleetwood Mac, who had relocated to LA in the hope of breaking America, were just another British rock band doing the rounds. Down to just the rhythm section, a female songwriter reluctant to front the band, and their latest guitarist, Bob Welch.
Bob Welch was our guitar player and had made several great albums with us. And he, at very short notice, at the end of a tour, the last gig, he decided, I'm gone, I'm done, out.
Meanwhile, a young American folk rock duo called Buckingham Nicks had also moved to Hollywood in search of musical fame.
You may not be as strong as me.
Coming from the growing genre of confessional songwriting, the couple had seen their debut album garner critical acclaim, but not much else. Dropped by their label, 8 years after becoming an item, they were back to square one, sharing a single room and waiting on tables.
I'd get home from my waitress job and we'd have dinner and then we'd start up working at 9 at night and we'd work till 3 and go to bed and get back up and he'd work on the music and I'd go and be a waitress. And so that's really what went on through 1974 till the last day of 1974. So it was about a year and 3 months from when it came out till the day that Mick Fleetwood called us.
The streets of Hollywood.
Met a guy in a supermarket who I knew vaguely, and I said, he said, oh, what are you doing? I said, well, actually, I'm looking for a studio. He said, well, I've just started working at Sound City, which is the studio in the Valley. And we drove to Sound City and walked into the studio. And Keith Olsen was an engineer. And I literally just was saying, well, what's the room sound like? And Keith put Buckingham Nicks, the master tape on, which he'd produced with Lindsay and Stevie. Just for something to play. And that's where I heard Lindsay's guitar playing.
Lindsay Buckingham, guitarist and singer.
I just happened to walk into Studio A, and I walked in right in the middle of this sort of blistering guitar solo at the end, and here's this really tall, skinny guy in the room just kind of doing this, and I really didn't know who it was. And then a week later, I got a call from Mick, and he said, well, our guitarist, Bob Welch, is leaving. Would you like to join the band?
Didn't think about Stevie one way or the other, because I was looking for a guitar player. I mean, Stevie's, you know, quote, never forgiven me. It was like, oh, you didn't want me, you just wanted Lindsay, right? Which was, right at the beginning, was true. And very quickly, we realized that they were totally joined at the hip.
And I said, well, I'll have to talk to my girlfriend about that, but if we do, you're going to have to take my girlfriend too.
A meeting was arranged that would define the future of Fleetwood Mac.
So we all met at a Mexican restaurant on 3rd Street in Los Angeles, and we all got on like a house on fire.
Everyone thought that it was a little unique that there were the two women. It was certainly unique that there were two couples.
And the only criteria with Christine was, we have to meet, because I just want to know that I get on with her. Because there's been nothing worse than two catcalling women that don't get on in a band. And she was right.
In the musical environment, I hadn't worked with another girl, you know. But when I met her, I instantly liked her. Not because she was like me, quite the contrary, we are totally unalike. me and Stevie. We're complete opposites of ends of the personality spectrum.
I said, you know, I think this woman, Christine McVie, is pretty fantastic, and this would give me somebody to hang out with.
In 1975, the new lineup gathered at Sound City to record their first album together and figure out how to marry a laid-back British blues trio to a folk rock duo with Californian ambition.
We had songs that were probably being tooled up to be maybe another Buck Hammix album.
Some of those songs went on to the first album they recorded with Fleetwood Mac, and Rhiannon was one of them.
She writes on the piano in a very, very rudimentary manner.
It's very much like this. It's dun 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 dun.
My tendency is to want to add rhythm and to rock it up. So it just bringing that thumb style that I have, it's just sort of somewhere between classical and folk.
Didn't know anything about Wales at the time, but it was kind of a, I always thought it was kind of like a Welsh country song, you know.
John plays.
Rehearsed before we went in the studio, and my sense was, my God, we're home and dry. Lindsay's a great performer, and Stevie was immediately in charge of her arena. The whole spell that she put over audiences with, you know, all the movement and all the lovely stuff.
Oh, now you know that. Chris Salovich, NME journalist.
She had the kind of the two voices, one of which is the kind of archetype or, you know, West Coast female singer-songwriter lilt, very sweet, very girly. But then there's also the almost Janis Joplin-like blues belting, both of which she uses to fine effect in Rhiannon, which of course was her stage tour de force.
Ken Kelly, record producer.
I'll never forget that one. I think it was a 1976 performance, and she was just screaming Rhiannon. I could remember her vocal cords were stretching out, and her, you know, the muscles were stretching, and she went a complete octave above where anybody could take that song.
The woman who'd been the plus one in the new lineup gave the band the hit single that propelled their album up the US charts. The band also realized that the key to their success was a luxurious, simple sound.
Less is more dictated the sound of the then Stevie and Lindsay incarnation of Fleetwood Mac.
When we joined Fleetwood Mac, it was kind of an exercise in paring down.
It's kicking a snare and a bass. So keep it simple and just and let the voices and Lindsay's guitars layer the rest of it.
We didn't even know what a harmony was with Peter Green. And then bingo.
The blend of the vocals, you know, Chris's voice, which is slightly husky, and Stevie's and Lindsay's, that blend wow. It's like, yeah, this is going to happen.
The band being photographed.
In 1977, as the band started writing songs for their next album, they were primed by their label for even bigger success. With one catch.
Going into the making of Rumours, all of us, like a convergence, Stevie and Lindsay, John and Chris, and me and Jenny, my then wife, all five band members were going into, you know, an emotional hiccup, to say the least.
When we joined Fleetwood Mac, everything was really rocky between me and Lindsay.
We had just our own sense of displacement.
I think we kind of all made like a little silent vow. Let's fix these relationships for right now, because we cannot break up. We just can't. If we do, there will be no Fleetwood Mac.
That's Rumours. That's the canopy that led us into the making of that album. If you wake up, don't smile. And within that framework was this incredible, you know, crosstalk of laser beams of emotion going from one personality to the other. Don't stop thinking about tomorrow. Don't stop. It'll soon be here. It'll be better than before. Yesterday's gone. Yesterday's gone. Don't stop, you know, is certainly Chris saying, I love you, but I'm not in love with you. To John.
You go back and you read them and you go, oh. Oh, okay. All I want is to see you smile. If it takes just a little while. No, you don't believe that it's true. I've never meant any harm to you.
Somebody's playing a song and everybody in the room's going, that's about me, right? You know, and of course it's about you, you know. But what you have to do is you have to let that go. Because if you don't let that go, you can never play any songs for anybody. My songs were all about Lindsay, and Lindsay's songs were all about me, and you just had to, you know, blow it off and play the song.
It was kind of an exercise in denial. It really was. That was the only way we could get through it. You had to put your feelings over here and get on with what needed to be done in the rest of the room.
Archive film of Christine.
I don't think we were really aware of it at the time until it was more or less completed, and then John, I think, made some reference to it sounding like a bunch of rumours, and I think that's how we ended up calling the album that. And the end result was just very moving when you listen to it back to back. Everything strung together as it was, like something of a diary.
Well, John McVie liked to drink, and I think he always had done, and I think he was kind of part of that whole tradition of English rock and rollers from the 60s, from, say, from John Mayall's era, who just liked to go out and get slaughtered, basically. And, you know, living in L.A., you know, he was still a member of John Mayall's Brain Damage Club.
I'm a legend in my own mind.
I was over the top. Way over the top, yeah. Beyond the pale, as it were. And she couldn't handle it anymore. And it happened when we were doing something down in Florida that I got the word. Basically, we weren't a unit anymore, and she'd rather be with our lighting director than me.
If the album gave Christine a chance to say to John, don't stop thinking about tomorrow, it also gave her a chance to tell her lighting director that he made loving fun. but Lindsay and Stevie weren't exactly singing along.
And they were both sitting on stools next to each other and singing into two microphones. We had to stop the tape or something, and suddenly they were screaming at each other, damn you, go to hell. And I quite honestly was embarrassed. I didn't know what to do. And so I rewound the tape as fast as I could. The moment I hit play, they were back into singing You Make Loving Fun Again, which I thought was very ironic.
Rumors was recorded at the record plant in San Francisco. And one afternoon, Stevie found a hidden corner of the studio to privately gather her thoughts on her failing relationship with Lindsay.
I was just hanging out in the rest of the record plant, and Sly Stone had a studio there, and the people that owned the studio let me in there, and I went in there with my Fender Rhodes, and I spent the afternoon in there, and I wrote Dreams. And they really liked it, and so we recorded it the next day, and this was before the final blow-up of me and Lindsay. But we were close, but we hadn't had that final blow-up yet. Now there you go again, you say you want your freedom, who am I to keep you down? I really was the one that wanted my freedom at that point, because I just wasn't happy in the relationship anymore. The relationship, in my opinion, had become too dark and too obsessive and too heavy. I just was looking for some spring air. I was just looking to breathe again.
I think the thing about Stevie Nicks is her style of writing is much more pastoral, whimsical, West Coast hippie, really. And Lindsay Buckingham, his style is a much tougher, almost punkier sound, actually.
Lindsay's strumming.
Lindsay, of course, had a riposte to Stevie's take on their relationship, complete with a dramatic opening and a rollicking backbeat.
I had this idea. It was actually taken from Street Fighting Man by the Rolling Stones, where Charlie Watts was going, and Mick didn't want to. He couldn't quite get that. He did his own thing, which was he did a 4/4, and he went.
Mick on the drums.
Loving you isn't the right thing to do. How can I ever change things that I feel?
Go your own way. It's a bitter, sweet testimony from a partner to another partner.
Well, I always looked at Go Your Own Way as Lindsay's Dreams.
Won't take it from me.
My Dreams was my kind of airy-fairy spirituality, saying, when the rain washes you clean, you'll know. In other words, we're all going to come out of this. And Lindsay, you and I will come out of this, and we'll be friends, and it'll be okay. And Lindsay's Dreams, which was Go Your Own Way, was angry and nasty.
Go your own way.
And in my opinion, extremely disrespectful to say, shacking up. And me, ladylike, prudish Stevie, which I am, was very offended by him saying, shacking up is all you want to do. Because I was not in any kind of a shacking up mood. I was not shacking up with anybody.
It may be a rather, truthful and blunt observation, but, that's the way he writes songs.
Archive film of Mick, playing with his mouth wide open, then Lindsay picking at his guitar.
was hired to do the job, I didn't understand. Lindsey always refused to sing his lyrics. And I found out later that the reason why he wasn't singing the lyrics because he knew it would make Stevie mad.
Lindsey and I broke up like on the last day. And we had a big fight. I don't remember what the fight was about, but we were getting ready to go home. And I basically said to him, well, I'll pack up the car and you drive it and I'm flying home and you drive. And we were done. Done.
A chart listing.
Dreams gave the band their first number one single in America, as rumors hit the ground running, selling 200,000 copies a day. Adult-oriented rock had truly arrived.
The success of that album was as much about people investing in us as people and realizing that a lot of this music was actually cross-dialogues to each other.
You know, Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks are just tearing apart. You know, they're pulling down the curtains of the bedroom. You know, they're opening the doors wide up. What's really going on in here? You know, all the group's neuroses are laid bare. It's that blend of the British blues sensibility with this almost neurotic and actually absolutely heartfelt lyric writing.
There's a darkness to it where that's been this band's saving grace, you know, where it started in my mind with Peter Green, you know. It's accessible and it's sort of pop music, but not.
There was one song on Rumours that wasn't released as a single, but became a showstopper and a kind of anthem for the band. The Chain.
The band drinking together.
It's ironic because it is a song about keeping together and somehow finding the tools and the vocabulary, you know, to not only do it in the moment, but to keep doing.
I mean, it's like nobody, no matter how bad it got, nobody didn't want to be in the band. Nobody wanted to get out of the band. So it was like, you know, the band was number one priority. So it's like the relationships did not override the band.
The group drinking and smoking on top of a ferry in typical 70s dress. They wave from the open top deck.
Rumours made Fleetwood Mac the biggest band in the world. They even had their own star on Hollywood Boulevard. But like Peter Green before him, success sat uneasily with frontman Lindsey, who felt the band were in danger of becoming dinosaurs.
He probably would have left Fleetwood Mac. He came up to my house. We spent a couple of days just talking about what he wanted to do. It was all about Lindsey's, you know, thing of we got to go forward.
A punk performance.
After Rumours in 1977, a new wave of young bands had arrived. And Lindsey, listening to The Clash and Talking Heads, was desperate for the band to experiment. In 1979, Fleetwood Mac released an elaborately packaged double album and spent the industry's biggest recording budget to date on this.
The album's stylized artwork, including a naked woman sitting up holding a large tusk between her thighs.
Nation's $4 billion a year record industry experienced an 11% drop in sales. Executives felt that one of the albums that could bring buyers back into the stores would be Fleetwood Mac's next release.
Tusks was a different sounding record than Rumours. I was all ready to go in and make another Rumours. But Lindsey had different ideas. Every idea that I suggested sound-wise, he wanted to go just the opposite.
The record company wanted us to really just make another Rumours. And Lindsey was really offended by that. And Lindsey is one of those people that will go up on the cross to make a point and die.
Lindsey was this volatile character. He was kind of a whacked out guy. I remember one day, and this is the time when he had this big kind of like afro. I looked up and all his hair was gone. It's just all the regular end. I said, what happened? He said, I was just in the shower and I just freaked out and I just cut it all off. And he really said, yeah, cut it all off. I was like, okay, well, we're all long hair and beards and you're like, look pretty strange here. But and that was the kind of thing he would do. He would just freak out.
You know, you've got to just do what is in your heart. And I was quite excited about trying some new approaches.
Hey, Dragon goes through the phone, baby. Yeah, but you never catch me. Yeah.
It took 13 months in one place, so we weren't moving around. So it was a long, long 13 months. We were recording at Village Recorders in Santa Monica, and we were recording 6 days a week, and we were all there every day. And, you know, we just got through it, and it was really horrible.
With a certain amount of trepidation, I did get the band into the idea of trying some new processes and some different sensibilities.
I remember one day he wanted to get a aggressive sounding vocal, and he had me tape the microphone on the tile floor, and he got down into push-up position and sang into this microphone sitting on the floor.
I still wouldn't mind trying that square one that Stevie uses on stage.
All right.
Two. What, this one you want?
Yep.
All right.
It's like Lindsay with the microphone on the tile floor, like, you know, laying on the floor with his head flat on the floor, like going, ooh, 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 ooh. And we're just all like, okay, that was great, take two. and he's like, ooh, 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 ooh. Okay, take three. And then he's taking the whole thing, and then he's slowing it down, and then he's recording that, and then he's speeding it back up, and then he's putting it through a Leslie organ speaker. And it was just hard for the rest of us because we weren't always involved.
The band resting on sofas.
We had a great little ante room, you know, little lounge room outside of it, and we would just be in the lounge, drinking coffee, watching television, eating, and waiting for Lindsay to say, okay, come on in, now there's something for you to do.
Here we are. Coffee's made. You gotta see, we lose track of time in here. I mean,
they can probably understand.
I just called my mother last night for the first time since Christmas. And,
you thought it'd been a month.
I thought it'd been about a month, right? I mean, not literally a month.
Yeah.
You do lose complete track of time. Because your days and your nights aren't set up right.
The most elaborate and expensive production was saved for the album's title track.
The track, Tusk, came out of a riff that Lindsay always used to play at soundcheck. And I came back and I said, well, what about putting a, you know, a 100-piece brass band playing the riff?
And we're all like, okay. Okay, if you can pull this off, Mick, then great.
And it was a weird one, you know. It was Mick's idea to put the USC marching band on there, which was a stroke of genius.
A baseball stadium.
We put the 120-piece brass band with Fleetwood Mac and recorded it at Dodger Stadium.
It really was an extraordinary day, and we did film it, thank goodness. And I got to twirl, and because my mom was a majorette, so my mom taught me to twirl when I was really little. So I got to do a little bit of that.
We're honorary members of the USC Marching Band.
Lindsay puts on one of the band's plastic Roman gladiator helmets.
Just say that you call me, hey.
archive footage of the band marching in their red and gold uniforms while playing their brass instruments. Fleetwood Mac are chatting in the arena.
The extravagant Tusk disappointed the record company by only managing a quarter of Rumour's sales figures. But as a live act, Fleetwood Mac was still a draw, and were accordingly booked onto a huge 18-month world tour.
I saw the Tusk tour in San Francisco at the Cow Palace, and the audience, it was kind of kids, you know, in the front rows. You know, they're screaming, they think it's fantastic to be there. It's like a kind of, you know, it's like a teenage rock and roll show.
An audience with their hands and lighters in the air in a large venue. A stream of vivid blue light is piercing the darkness. Mick wiggles his tongue.
On the extensive Tusk tour, things got indulgent. Perhaps because Fleetwood Mac had sacked their previous manager and were newly managed by their drummer.
Mick was managing the band. Mick's a dreamer, and he's not an accountant. Let's just leave it at that.
We went through a really bad experience with, let's put it, our now ex-manager. You remember that, Mum?
Yes, I did indeed.
We never had another manager.
Very good.
And
good thing too.
Here it sits.
This is manager.
You know, I think there was a tendency to get the biggest plane we could get to travel in, and all for, you know, reasons of wanting things to be great.
It costs between $25,000 and $30,000 a day just to keep Fleetwood Mac on the road. But the investments in luxury jets and the separate limousines that emphasize their individual styles are the group's own decision.
Backstage footage.
We all make reference to this thing called the bubble, you know, the Fleetwood Mac canopy, where a world within a world, as Lindsay would say, existed. Some of it very insane, really.
The Tusk tour was legendary for its success. And one of the things that I noticed was that backstage, in the same way that kind of at that point where people were just getting into drinking Perrier water instead of tap water, Fleetwood Mac had bottles of oxygen. Even their air came out of tanks.
Mick puts a plastic mask to his face and inhales.
We, at that point, were for sure, you know, like little kids in a toy shop.
Stevie playfully dabs lipstick on Mick's lips.
I just remember things got larger. We were doing the US Festival with the Eagles, 250,000 people.
An audience applauding with their arms above their heads.
It just grew.
Lindsay wipes his face with a towel.
I mean, the excess around Fleetwood Mac is well known. And there seemed to be a lot of alcohol and a lot of Peruvian marching powder. But I think this was all fuel to keep them all going, because I could tell, even in 76, when I met them in LA, they were all exhausted already. They were absolutely knackered. They needed fuel.
Roadies packing stage equipment away.
To make matters even more complicated, behind Lindsay's back, Stevie and Mick had started seeing each other.
Wait a minute, baby. Stay with me, why?
The band lying together in a bed on the front of Rolling Stone magazine.
But you never told me about the fire.
Stevie and myself had a great relationship, but it was not in the open. It was not, you know, open. It was a very private affair, really.
And then Mick fell in love with my best friend, Sarah. And my best friend, Sarah, moved in with Mick and left her husband.
the awkwardness, no doubt, the dastardly deed was that Sarah was and still is a great friend of Stevie's. And it was the classic, intergalactic, mess. And out of that came certainly that song, Sarah.
Said Sarah, you're the poet in my heart. Never change, never stop.
So there we were, recording Tusk, with Lindsay, who has never really gotten over this relationship with me, and now Mick has done this thing, and he's living with my friend Sarah, and she's banished from the studio. And so I lost Mick and my friend Sarah in one fell swoop.
A spotlight illuminates a guitarist on the stage who has his back to the audience.
Being in Fleetwood Mac to this day is very tense. It's a tense situation, always. Was from the very beginning and is now. In my solo career, I'm not tense. I'm not uptight because I don't have any reason to be uptight.
In 1981, Stevie, who was becoming a star in her own right, launched a parallel solo career. Her first album, Belladonna, eclipsed Fleetwood Mac's album Mirage, topping US and UK charts, and conjured three hit singles, including the spellbinding Edge of 17.
She was the ultimate West Coast hippie dream girl. You know, in her hotel room, there would be a lot of scarves and silk objects draped over every possible lamp and light bulb everywhere.
Stevie has a real fondness for accessories and playing with things and becoming characters on stage.
It just evolved. You know, the top hat. I think that she had a cane at one point. And then the chiffon, and it grew, and she developed it.
When she puts on a shawl, she literally becomes another character.
Margie Kent, Stevie's stylist.
She's so petite on stage, and they started doing larger and larger arenas. So she wanted something that would really show that she's there, that she's moving, and it would be dramatic. If you go to concerts, you'll see many, many people dressed like her in various stages of her career. They are dressed to the nines like Stevieites all over the place.
People remember, oh my God, you remember when we were in the audience and we'd see thousands of Stevie Nickses, Rihanna.
Thank you for being with us on this very special night. Good night.
The cult of Stevie Nicks grew, but was laced with rumors about a growing dependence on a particular brand of stardust.
Stevie gathers toys and flowers from the stage.
The cocaine became very prevalent during rumors. And everybody was doing it.
There used to be a bag of the community bag of cocaine on the console.
When we got into Tusk, into the recording of Tusk, and the thing happened with me and Mick and Sarah, that was really a drag. And of course, so every time something really bad happened, everybody started doing more coke, just to get through. And so it got, it was out of control.
Black and white photographs of the band members.
Shatter your illusions of love.
I didn't stop doing coke until I went to Betty Ford in 1985. So our cocaine addict selves went pretty much from the beginning of 1977 till, for me anyway, till 1985. I don't know when everybody else stopped because nobody else went to rehab but me. So I have a documented timeline on me, but I don't really know what everybody else did. But it, you know, it was totally out of hand. And it I thought it was going to kill me.
In the mid-80s, Fleetwood Mac burnt out and fell apart and was silent for a full 5 years. But in 1987, still carrying relationship and substance problems, they reconvened uneasily for Tango in the Night.
That was the culmination for me of individual lifestyles having gone beyond the point to which there was anything you could defend about it helping creativity, being anything other than destructive of the creative process.
Tell me lies, tell me sweet little lies. Tell me lies, tell me lies.
Stevie, her solo career had pulled her off in various directions, but even so, she just was not present mentally or physically when she was there, and she wasn't there very much. I mean, that album probably took 8 months or so, a little longer, to record, and we probably saw her all of 2 weeks, the whole time.
I hope that you understand there's a reason why.
That was when I was on Klonopin, which is a tranquilizer. And that was after coke. That was after I came after. I went to Betty Ford. I was off the coke. I was fine. And a psychiatrist decided that what I really needed was to be on Klonopin because it would calm me down. It would keep me from going back to coke. And this drug was more deadly than the coke for me. And so what Lindsay was dealing with on Tango in the Night was the fact that when you're on tranquilizers, you really can't be depended on. So I would get there late, or I wouldn't get there at all. So that was hard for him.
Lindsay under a spotlight on stage.
The biggest hit on Tango in the Night was a very personal testimony from Lindsay, a driven musical leader of the band, with the relationship issues that had taken him into a dark place.
Is an important song to me because if you look at the lyric, it did describe accurately the person I was in 1987.
You said that you love me.
I had a lot of relationships which were less than ideal, and probably much of that being my doing, you know. That song, Big Love, is about being up on the hill and looking out for love, but that's the point. I'm not looking for love, I'm looking out for love. I'm sort of defending against love, you know.
Just looking out for love. A big, big love.
Tango in the Night was Fleetwood Mac's biggest seller since Rumours and breathed new life into their career. But there was one dance partner dragging his feet.
I didn't really want to be a part of that kind of excess. And usually my experience has been if you have that in the studio, it's usually about times 10 on the road. So that's when I exited the band.
A news article reads, Lindsay Buckingham leaves Fleetwood Mac. Band adds two members and hits the road for a 10-week tour.
I remember him quitting when we had a meeting at Christine's house because the tour had been booked. Because the album ended up coming out really good. It was a big tour. And he just sat there in the chair and said, I can't go. I don't want to go. And we all just like, well, you have to go because we can't, you know, you as an artist, you cannot put all the promoters out of business.
It was certainly a negative thing to do as far as the band was concerned, and they were very hurt by it, but I just felt I needed to somehow reclaim my sanity and my own sense of individuality.
When Lindsay said, "I'm not going," I think I got up and ran across the room and tried to strangle him. And then he chased me out of the house through Christine's driveway, and we had a huge fight. And that was that. He was done.
The Reynolds Girls performing a duet on Top of the Pops.
By the end of the 80s, things had definitely moved on. The band carried on without Lindsay, but the Reynolds Girls and a younger generation now saw Fleetwood Mac as out-of-touch oldies. An image not helped by Mick's unfortunate foray into presenting on 1989's disastrous outing of the Brits.
The fabulous, the legendary, the sensational, the Four Tops.
You don't look like him, George.
No, I'm the One Top. The Four Tops have been held up. They're putting their makeup on.
Inspired by Bill Clinton's use of Don't Stop as his campaign theme, the band staged a full reunion in 1997, complete with the entire USC marching band. Tough. The millennium was even kinder to the band. A younger generation discovered their back catalogue. Destiny's Child sampling Stevie's Edge of 17 for Bootylicious. Pop's Intelligentsia, noting their influence on a new crop of young bands. After their reunion, a weary Christine McVie decided to retreat from America and the band.
I think that was it, and I just said, I just have to go home. It still took me 5 years to finally move back here. But no, I have had no regrets.
But the remaining four members released a new album and staged two sell-out world tours to rave reviews. You can go your own way. Go your
own way. We just come back from New York, and I don't think the band's played better.
I mean, this is a great body of work we've got, and that allows you to sort of all the other good feelings and the other more objective and positive aspects about how you feel about the people to follow.
Perhaps some of that good feeling is down to the fact that Lindsay, in middle age, has stopped looking out for love and finally found it.
I'm so happy that he fell on his feet with a family and had a whole life outside of a very intense attitude he has to creativity, his life, what he wants to accomplish. And inadvertently, I think it's broadened his scope amazingly.
It's the best thing that ever happened to me, you know. I mean, I can honestly say, you know, at age 59, this is the best time of my life.
Two other band members have found that relocating to a faraway paradise is one way of surviving Fleetwood Mac.
John McVie lives in Oahu, one of the islands here in Hawaii. This is Maui. This is my home. And we thought just to let you know, how cold is it back there? The rhythm section, still together, but we're not freezing, we're in Hawaii. We love England, we love Europe. But
I don't like being cold.
I don't like being cold.
At this age, it's too much.
The arthritis.
He waves at the camera with a smile.
Good Lord, I hope you don't use that.
I'm sure they will, John.
Stevie and Lindsay alone on stage.
But back inside the Fleetwood Mac bubble, every night on tour, the couple who made the band superstars are still working things through.
Took this love and I took it down. I climbed a mountain and I turned around.
There's still, with Stevie and Lindsay, a healing process which may very well go on to both of their dying days.
Till the landslide brought me down.
I met her when I was about 16. She transferred to my high school. I was a junior, she was a senior, she was 17. So it's been, you know, most of my life.
Lindsay's and my relationship started in 66 and went through 77. So when we finally really broke up at the end of the recording of Rumors, it was devastating. And it was not the way he wanted it to go. So there's been a payback all these years.
Sadly, probably the lion's share of those years, there has been distance and animosity, you know, of some kind, mixed in with everything else, too. It's never been just one thing.
You know, Lindsay and I will never be touchy-feely friends.
But time makes you bolder, children get older.
She's in the process of learning how to trust me again as someone who is her friend.
You know, I've never been to Lindsay's house and probably never will go to Lindsay's house. Lindsay's been here once. Maybe down the line in 10 or 15 years when Lindsay and I are 75, we'll be friends again. When Fleetwood Mac is a distant memory and his kids will be grown, he has three really precious children, they'll be gone. You know, people say, you know, as time passes, the wounds heal. Maybe, you know, later on down the line, all those wounds will heal.
Can I handle the seasons of my life? I don't know.
From agony to ecstasy, from the pits to the pinnacle.
It's such a unique dynamic with a group of people, and it's nice to still be here doing it.
Fleetwood Mac is bigger, grander, heavier, and way more tense.
I mean, hey, we're still talking about it, but it's okay. You know, we're all in our 60s now.
We ain't finished yet.
And if you see my reflection in the snow, cover him. Well, maybe the landslide will bring it down. Well, the landslide bring it.